We are starting a new paragraph in Romans 4 this evening. We have been working in Romans 4 with Paul's basic question as he opened the chapter about what Abraham discovered in relation to the entire issue of being qualified by God to be able to be blessed by God. For many weeks we've been looking into this question. As Abraham was the original recipient of the promise that Paul is dealing with, we've seen that Paul has focused his attention and ours on the bottom line in Abraham's discovery. It has to do with this business of being reckoned righteous by God, because that is the bottom line. Without a condition of acceptance before God based on righteousness, the rest of thinking and doing is basically a vanity. God cannot bless a man with any provision of good unless he has the freedom to do so. And the freedom to do so is attached to the whole issue of the justice of God. Justice with God is not an optional issue. He must be just. Otherwise, he's unjust. And if he's unjust, then we have no hope, and of course the whole universe is in chaos. So justice is not one of those optional things, and refraining from giving man what he deserves is fundamentally unjust. And the problem, of course, with that is that all men deserve to be condemned. And so you have this enormous problem from the justice perspective. So that it's no accident that in chapter 3, in verses 25 and 26, Paul deliberately strove to argue that God has never been unjust, because the issue of Jesus and the issue of justice, so that God could both be just and justify the ungodly, that could be met by the vicarious sacrificial death of the Son of God in our place as a substitute for us. Probably the big Old Testament, most widely known story of what that's all about is the story of David and Goliath. Because the story of David and Goliath is not only one of those really well-known Bible stories, because everybody's heard about, you know, little David and great big Goliath and how he slew this giant because he depended on God and all that. And it's an interesting story, and it's one of the most popular ones, especially with young people. But the basic gist of that story was that there was an agreement between the two armies that all the armies would be focused into one individual, so that Goliath represented the entire army of the Philistines, and David represented the entire army of the Israelites. So that however this one-on-one conflict came out would determine the entire conflict issue. So that if Goliath won, Israel became the slave of the Philistines. If Israel won, then the Philistine army was defeated. It's the idea of a champion, where one person takes on the responsibility for the whole, and whatever happens to the one happens to all. And of course that's the biblical doctrine of Adam as the head of the human race and Jesus Christ as the head of the new human race, the new creation. But whatever Adam did affected everybody that was connected to Adam, and what Jesus did affects everybody who's connected to him. So that's the mindset, and that's how God resolved the justice issues. And it's not an accident that the whole point of God passing over sins previously committed, verse 25 of chapter 3 addresses that idea that men get the idea that God's unjust because he doesn't hammer people instantly whenever they deserve it. They think that because injustice exists in the world, that God is unjust because he doesn't deal with it instantly or immediately to correct it or to rectify it. Well, if justice were the only issue, he would. And nobody'd survive. In a little while, there wouldn't be any human beings on the planet. In fact, if he'd had acted justly, Adam and Eve would have never had their first kid. They'd have been dead already. So the whole human race would have been wiped out. But the Bible says in 1 Peter 1:20 that Jesus was ordained from the foundation of the world to be the Redeemer, and Revelation 13:8 says that he was slain from the foundation of the world. So those phrases tell us that God was free to not visit justice on humanity immediately, because he already had in place this whole redemptive program, and Jesus actually came into history and accomplished it about 4,000 years into the process, but it was a plan that had been established by God from the beginning. So that's how God was free to be merciful, to be gracious, because his Son satisfied the issues of justice. Now, the gospel is that because God himself satisfied the true necessities of justice, he is now, therefore, free to treat men as though they don't deserve his wrath. He's able to be gracious or merciful to them. The question has always been not whether men have sinned, not whether they deserve eternal condemnation, even though most of them don't really think they're that bad. They don't even realize that you don't have to be that bad, you just have to be bad, which means you have to have sinned. Well, if you get rid of the idea that there are big bad sins that you earn eternal condemnation over, and then there are these other little things that are not, God doesn't recognize any of that. Sin deserves death. Death is eternal in its extent if a person goes into that. So it's never been a question of whether men have sinned. Everybody says, well, nobody's perfect. That's a real easy excuse way to get out of having to say everybody has sinned. We like the nobody's perfect terminology better because it doesn't make us look so bad. But the fact is, we're all sinners and nobody really debates that except a few very blind people. That's not been the question. The question is, how can God treat sinners as saints? That's the question. And of course, that was the issue that Paul raised and answered in chapter 3. He can treat them like saints because he sent his Son to take care of the justice issue. Now, Paul's answer then in chapter 4, when he raises the question of what Abraham discovered in light of this whole issue, is that a person can be reckoned righteous by God on the basis of faith in what God has done, not merely what God has said. Now, we do know that it begins with what he says. Abraham was taken by God outside and said, enumerate the stars if you're able, that's what your seed's going to be like. And when Abraham believed that statement from God, God determined him righteous on the basis of his faith. That's what Genesis 15:6 says. But that's on the basis of what God said. The issue is, was what he said going to ever be legitimate in history? And that depended on the coming of Jesus, his success in the temptation in the wilderness with the devil, his vicarious and willful, deliberate death in the place of sinners, where he took sin upon himself. All of that rested, the integrity of what God said rested on the historical activity of the doing. So our justification and our being reckoned righteous by God is not just on the basis of what God has said, but on the basis of what he's done, and whether we believe it or not. And so that's one of the issues that's being raised in verse 16 of chapter 4. That is what our study about is going to be mostly about this evening, the issue of whether God's words can be turned into lies. He says in verse 16, for this reason it is by faith, that it might be in accordance with grace, in order that the promise may be certain. The phrase, in order that the promise may be certain, means that if it's not by grace, and thus not by faith, it is not certain. So it had to be by faith so that it could be by grace so that it could be certain. And the certainty issue is it had to be something that God was actively going to accomplish in history as a certifiable, finished, done fact so that it could not be undercut or turned over, could never be turned into a lie. And that's what Paul is raising. That's the issue in verse 16. The certainty of the promise. The fact that it had to be by faith so that it could be by grace so that it could be certainty. So this evening what we're going to do is we're going to look at this issue of how God's promise is absolutely true, so that it is certain. We saw in our study last time that in verse 14, if those who are of the law are heirs, faith is made uncertain because it's made an empty bubble and promise is actually nullified. That would create the uncertainty. In fact, it would destroy the validity of the promise. And the reason is because if those who are of the law are heirs, then this whole business depends on human choices and actions and all of that. And if it depends on human choices and actions, we know where that'll take us. It'll take us straight where this world's going, because that's where human choices and actions are most clearly seen. So what we want to do this evening is look at this business of, for this reason it's by faith that it might be according to grace, so that the promise might be certain. The last half of the verse is that the promise might be certain to all the descendants, and then he divides the descendants into two groups, those who are of the law and those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. The issue of those who are of the law has to be understood in light of verse 13, that the promise to Abraham that he would be the heir of the world was not through law, but through the righteousness of faith. And verse 12, where he is the father of circumcision to those who are not only circumcised, but also follow in the steps of the faith. So it's the faith that does it, not the circumcision. And that's where I'd like to start this evening, just recapping out of the last half of verse 16, what's going on here. And I'll just call it the greater plan. The greater plan behind the promise. God made this promise that has to be certain. Well, what was the greater plan that was behind the promise? Well, first of all, Paul clearly saw that God has always had a greater plan than just Israel or just the circumcised in relation to an eternal state of total blessedness. From our point of view, 2,000 years after Paul, and of course having the New Testament complete so that we have the book of Revelation, for example, as the final picture, we know that God has in mind a new heavens and a new earth, a city that is going to be inhabited by the church, and kings on the earth who are going to bring their glory into the city on a periodic basis. So we know that the eternal vision is of a new earth that is populated by people who have kings over them. That's what the vision of Revelation 21 and 22 says. That's the future. It's unfolding in that direction. God's plan has always been a greater plan than just Israel in relation to this whole business of the eternal future. Now, the plan has always been for Abraham and his seed to do what verse 13 said, and that is to inherit the world. He says in verse 13, the promise to Abraham and or to his seed that he would be the heir of the world. That's the content of the promise. Well, what does it mean to be the heir of the world? Well, we studied that in verse 13, but basically it has this perspective of the eternal vision of a new heavens, new earth, and an eternal inheritance in this new earth for Abraham and his seed. And there are echoes in this promise of the original creation in Genesis 1 and 2 and 3, where God originally created a garden, a bounded garden, a localized, circumscribed area called the Garden of Eden. And he created the first human beings and placed them in this garden that God had planted. And he gave them instructions to tend the garden and to multiply and fill the earth. Which means that he started out with a mile square garden. And he put two people in it and he said, now I want you to tend this garden. I want you to keep it in this pristine condition of the garden. And then as you have children and you need more space, you can expand the boundaries of the garden. And as you multiply and fill the earth, eventually the garden will cover the whole earth. That was the original vision that was given to Adam and Eve in the beginning. Well, the problem for that was there came into this garden a problem. And we all know the Genesis 3 record there, and I'm going to come back to that in a little bit. But I just want you to be aware that the eternal vision of a new heaven and new earth, with human beings just kind of inheriting this whole ball of wax, that is an echo of the original vision that was given to Adam that he forfeited in Genesis 3. The second thing is that there's also an echo here of the Tower of Babel, because the inheritance of the world and the idea of Abraham being the father of us all, and especially verse 17 of Romans 4, a father of many nations. Where did the nations come from? Well, we're told that. Originally, in Babel, the world was the people had all congregated in one place, and there was basically one nation. And this was in direct contradiction to what God had said. So, given the fact that they were in contradiction to what he'd said, plus they were skillfully manipulating and working toward enormous evil, God said, if we don't do something, nothing will be prohibited to them in terms of the greatness of their evil. So, he confused their languages. Well, the direct outworking of the confusion of the languages of the nations. So here was the basis for Abraham being the father of a multitude of nations, was Babel. That's where the nations came from. On the basis of linguistics, God forced the human race into multinational identities. Well, that's the background. And the plan, as we've seen it in Genesis 17 with circumcision, obviously had two parts. In Genesis 17, verses 4 and 5, God told Abram that he would be the father of a multitude of nations, and then he gave him a covenant of circumcision and said that those who are under that covenant will be the heirs of the land of Canaan. So circumcision became the national identity mark. So there were multiple nations, but this one nation was going to practice circumcision under a specific covenant alignment with God, and the rest of the nations were never going to be subject to this law. They were never going to come into this covenant of law that God imposed on the people who were going to inherit Canaan, which he did at Sinai before he ever let them go into the land. So the covenant of circumcision in this whole chapter 4, is really just a statement about how God had worked out the details of the plan. Abraham was going to be the father of everybody who believed, whether he was a Jew or a Gentile or what, but he was going to be the father of the believing circumcised and the believing uncircumcised. So the plan involves multinational identities. The nations are going to come into this faith of Abraham. That's the background. But in order for this plan to work, there had to be an effective mechanism to impose it upon human history in the light of the rebellion of Genesis 3. The rebellion in the garden in Genesis 3 did three things all at the same time. In the first place, the serpent came into the garden with an alternative plan that was completely at odds with God's plan. This alternative plan was fundamentally a different vision of the future, of the eternal future. In the vision of the eternal future, which we have, as we've already pointed out from Revelation 21:22, you have the kingdoms of a new earth bringing their glory into the heavenly city where the bride of the Lamb resides and where the Lamb himself sits on the throne in the New Jerusalem. Well, the alternative plan was a plan in which certain members of the angelic host would become what I'm going to call the Lord host, the overlords, and humans would become the ministering host. That's a complete subversion of the Hebrews 1:14 statement, because in Hebrews chapter 1, the question is raised, to which of God's created beings did he give the help of Messiah? It was not to the angels. It was to the human beings. And the reason was because the angels had been created as ministering spirits sent forth to minister to the heirs of salvation. Well, there were a bunch of these angelic beings that didn't want to be the servants of the humans. And under Lucifer, they rebelled. They rebelled against the eternal vision of a kingdom of servants. And they imposed in place of it, or proposed in place of it, an overlord kingdom. Where in the kingdom of the overlords, the angels would be the bosses, the humans would be the slaves, and the angels could have everybody serving them. That's the whole idea of the overlord kingdom. I'm the boss, and you do what I tell you. And Lucifer came into the garden with the clear intent to subvert Adam's headship over God's creation so that he could take it. And he succeeded, because he told Jesus in the temptation in the wilderness that the kingdoms of this world and the glory of them belonged to him, and he could distribute them as he chose. Well, that's true, because Adam had forfeited his right to be the Lord of the creation. Well, that alternative plan was actually a plan intended by Satan and his angelic followers to subvert the plan of God and turn the angels into the overlords and make the humans be the ministering servants. And that alternative plan also established the conflict that has been raging ever since over whether you're going to have a servant kingdom or you're going to have a overlord kingdom. And that's why even the leaders of the church are commanded not to lead by demand, but by example. So they don't lord it over the flock of God, but they lead by example. That's because the kingdom that they're leading is a servant kingdom and not an overlord kingdom. Lording it over means you've bought into the satanic rebellious vision. Well, this is where a lot of this is coming out of. In order for God to establish the certainty of the promise, he's got to have a mechanism that will address that rebellion. The second thing that this rebellion in the garden accomplished was it saddled humanity with not only the alternative vision, you can be as God, you know, the overlord thing. It not only saddled humanity with that alternative vision, but it saddled humanity with an inherent bondage to the pursuit of that vision. It is not an accident that every human being who ever comes in this world comes in screaming wanting their way. It's not an accident. Humanity has been saddled with a sinfulness that is a demanding bondage to pursue my way. I'm going to be the boss. I'm going to be the overlord. That's the vision of the satanic rebellion, and it's something that humanity's been saddled with. Adam's sin did not just transfer the kingdoms of this world to Lucifer. It did something to him and to all of his offspring that enforces the bondage of the overlord concept. Enforces it. There is something profoundly twisted about every human being that's born because he comes into this world enslaved to the notion that he ought to get his way. That's the essence of the law of sin in our members. But it's a part and parcel of us. And Paul says, the only way we're ever going to get rid of it is for this body, in which it's transferred from generation to generation, for this body to die. Then it can be resurrected free from the law of sin. And once it's resurrected in freedom, the bondage is gone. So not only did this alternative plan get generated in the garden, but it saddled humanity with the bondage. So that Jesus said, whoever sins is the servant of it. And nobody escapes the charge of sin, so nobody escapes the bondage. And then, finally, it also put the entire plan of God at risk as far as men's way of looking at it's concerned, and that's why Paul is dealing in verse 16 of chapter 4 with this question of certainty. Is it at risk or is it certain? That's the question. And it's a question that we have to answer either by faith or in unbelief. We either believe that God's plan is on track and is going to be accomplished, in which case the promise is certain, or we sit back and look at all of the stuff that's going on and say, God can't possibly still be in control of this mess. It's gotten away from him. And that's the position of unbelief. And the cynicism of unbelief just chews us up whenever we yield to that. So then the question becomes, how can God effectively overturn the imposed rebellion and return humanity to blessedness? How can he do it? And that question of the effective mechanism. How is God going to accomplish this? The only answer is involved in the question. The question is, how can God? And the answer is, God can. Because in the final analysis, verse 16 is saying that it is by faith so that it can be by grace, which means God in action. So there is either certainty or the promise is a vacuous myth. That's what verse 14 and 15 said. If it's by law, it's uncertain. And not only is it uncertain, it is hopeless. Because the law proves everybody's a sinner, therefore there's no righteousness before God. If there's no righteousness before God, there's no blessing from God. If there's no blessing from God, the promise is a lie. So there's either certainty or there's this emptiness. So the issue of certainty becomes a twofold issue. One of them has to do with that effective mechanism. How is God going to actually bring this about? And Paul has already established the claim that the mechanism is going to have to do with men becoming righteous in God's sight so that he can reckon them righteous, establish them in the inheritance of the world, and bless them so that he treats them as saints and not as sinners. That's how it's going to work. But Paul has already shown in verses 14 and 15 that if the mechanism has to do with men buying into the vision of a servant kingdom and then putting their shoulders to that plow in a covenant commitment with God, promise becomes empty of reality. And faith in that is a bubble of emptiness because men cannot buy into the vision of a servant kingdom. They're already enslaved to a contrary vision. Men are committed, heart, soul, mind, and strength, to getting their way. That's why they get mad at God when he doesn't do what they tell him to. An enormous number of the prayers that the saints pray are not requests, they're demands. We just tell God what to do. And most of the time, we haven't the foggiest idea what really needs to be done. We just know what we want. And so even for believers, even for relatively mature believers, much of the time, our expression is the expression of the overlord kingdom. And that proves that man by himself is not going to buy into a servant kingdom. Because what is the problem with the servant kingdom? I'll never get my way. If I have to be a servant, then everybody else gets what they want, and I never get what I want. And that is at the heart of all the conflict that exists in our universe. Somebody saying, but I'll never get what I want. I'm not going to be a doormat. I'll never get what I want if I have to just be a servant all the time. Well, you see where the problem is? We can't buy into this servant kingdom vision without some supernatural work. So, in order for God to establish a mechanism that will actually work, one of the first things he's going to have to do is bring man back to the foundation that he forsook in the garden, and that is the foundation of the integrity of the Word of God. God had said, if you do this, this is going to happen. Satan said, if you do this, that's not going to happen. So it became a faith issue. And that's why it's all been by faith ever since. Because man's problem in the beginning was he didn't believe. And God says, okay, we're not going to be able to rectify that until we rectify the problem of your refusal to believe me when I tell you that this is the way it's going to be. That's where the effective solution starts. It starts with God saying, this went off track when you refused to believe me, and it's going to get back on track when you start believing me. So that's one of the things that's going to have to happen. But obviously, the faith thing is not the big thing. This is where all the focus is, because that's where we say it all went off track. But behind this is the more subtle reality of the love thing, because this is where the heart of the servant kingdom gets its impetus from love. You'll never hear somebody who genuinely loves saying, "But I can't get my way." What they're saying is, "I want to be loved, but I don't want to love." Well, this is where the servant kingdom gets its impetus. It's not the question of whether you're being loved. It's whether you want to love somebody, whether you're willing to be a servant to somebody else. That's the whole point. The focus is here, fortunately. If God made salvation by love, none of us would ever be saved. He puts the focus here because it is by believing in His love that we then become capable of love. So faith is kind of in the mix there. But the point is, behind both of these, the question still exists, how is God going to do this? The promise has to be certain. Well, how can the promise be certain? Well, everything about promise rests on one foundational principle. That's the one that Abraham actually discovered in verse 21, and we've referred to it many times in this chapter. And that is, God made the promise, up to him to keep it. That's the fundamental bottom line. The only way this promise is going to be certain is if there's somebody who can make it certain. And God's the only one that can make the promise certain. He's the only one big enough. He's the only one powerful enough. He's the only one wise enough. He's the only one skillful enough. He's the only one knowledgeable enough. He's the only one that can make the promise certain. And in order for that power and love and wisdom and all that to work, something has to be in place. And according to verse 16, it runs like this. It has to be by faith so that it can be by grace, because by grace means God moves into operation. Everything under promise hinges on the one making the promise being obligated to fulfill it. Now, you know, with people, we'll make a promise to somebody, and then when our promise becomes a lie, we'll start blaming somebody for the reason why that happened. It'll never be us. "Oh yeah, I know I promised you that, but if you hadn't done this and this and this, I could have fulfilled it, but because you did this and this and this, or they did this, that, you know, that's the reason why it failed." Well, God's not into that game. He made the promise. He's not going to have any excuses about why it didn't happen. If he wants to blame people, he's got a whole universe full of people he can blame. But that doesn't mean the promise is certain. God doesn't take that out. We do, because we're fallen. We don't want to admit that we can't keep our promises, but God's not that way. You don't blame after failure with God. Promise is promise. And the underwriter is the one who makes the promise. So, here are the problems that promise faces. First, there's the matter of the heart. Why should anybody buy into the servant kingdom scenario? Don't you know that if you buy into the servant kingdom scenario, you will never get to have your way again? So, why would anybody buy that? Well, there's another question. Can any kingdom stand if nobody in it's a servant? Doesn't a house divided against itself guarantee its own destruction? Doesn't a house running around with everybody in it saying, "I want my way," guarantee the destruction of that house? So, on the one hand, men aren't inclined to buy the vision, but on the other hand, that vision's the only one that'll ever work. House divided against itself can't stand. So, when we ask the question, why should anybody buy into a servant king scenario, you have to understand what you're buying. You're buying into, "I will never get my way again." And that's not going to happen to people who've already bought into that other kingdom concept unless their purchase is revoked, unless they're regenerated, unless their whole mindset's turned around. And so one of the things that has to happen is God has to change the heart. That's why the essence of the new covenant is, "I will take out of them that stony heart and replace it with a sensitive, feeling heart." That's the first thing that's got to happen. God's got to change the heart. That's why chapter 2, verse 29 says, true circumcision is when God operates on the heart, circumcises the heart. makes it sensitive again. The point, though, that I want to make here is that, first of all, there has to be an operation at the heart level. The values of man have to change. He's got to stop wanting his own way. He's got to start wanting God to have his way more than he wants his own. That's not a humanly accomplished thing. That's God circumcising the heart. He can do it, and he has done it. For countless hundreds and thousands of people over 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 years of human history, he's been circumcising hearts all along the way, because that's what he does with his people. That's how they become his people. They buy his vision by his circumcision of their hearts. The second thing, however, is the matter of the mind. How can a servant kingdom where you don't get to have your way ever emerge victorious over the overlord kingdom concept? If everybody is saying, I'm going to be on the side of the overlords, I'm going to buy into the vision of the one that might makes right, and the ones with the guns are going to be the ones who call the shots, and we're going to rule, and we're going to dominate, and we're going to force our way, and the servant kingdom isn't going to resist that. James 5 says, the godly don't resist the ungodly. Well, how then can the... how can the servant kingdom ever come out on top? Well, it can't until Jesus comes back. Because when he comes back, he is not coming back to submit to the servant kingdom issues of the first coming. He is coming back to establish the servant kingdom. And the establishment of the servant kingdom is predicted in Scripture as coming on the heels of the exclusion, lest I say the execution of, all of the people who bought into the overlord vision. He is going to cast them into outer darkness. He's going to put them in their place so that those who have bought the servant kingdom vision by the circumcision of their hearts by God are going to inherit the kingdom. It's not our job to bring about the servant kingdom. It's our job to be servants until the king comes. So the reality of human bondage makes any expectation from the human side of the thing completely hopeless. It isn't going to happen on the basis of human activity. That's what Paul is saying in verse 16. In order for the promise to be certain, it's got to be by grace, because grace by definition is God in action. Remember? Grace is God doing for us what he requires of us and then giving us credit for what he's done when we trust him. But the fundamental definition of grace is God doing. That's why it's so frustrating to hear people say, oh, I believe in the grace of God, while they're living blatantly in contradiction to his word, because what they're saying is, I don't believe in the grace of God, because they've turned grace into something that's not real. The grace of God is God in action. When you believe in the grace of God, you believe in God in action. And when you believe in God in action, he's acting. He's doing. And so, by definition, grace is God in action. And that's how the certainty comes, because God's in action. And the only way that it works, according to verse 16, is it's got to be by faith, so that it can be by grace, so that the promise can be certain. Well, the grace makes the promise certain, but who's it certain to? Those who believe it. That's why it has to be by faith, so that it can be by grace. You see, promise was never intended to produce one good thing for a person who doesn't believe it. None of the promises of God are applicable to anybody that doesn't believe them. That's why Jesus said, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, God will go into action. If you don't have faith as a grain of mustard seed or any other kind, then God will not act on your behalf. The promises are void to you, because without faith, your approach is the overlord approach. You trying to force your will, and God will oppose that day after day after day until he finally destroys it. So there's no hope from that direction. That's why it's got to be by faith. Human beings have to decide in terms of what they are thinking of, as to whether they're going to believe what God has said or not. And even the ability to make that decision is something that rests very much with God, because He is the one who works in you both to will and to do of His good pleasure. But because it is by faith, it takes it out of the human performance area, because faith and law are the contrast here. It takes it out of the human performance area, and it puts it entirely in the divine performance area, because faith says, I believe that God will do this. And that means it's in the divine performance area. That's what faith means. I'm not going to do this. I'm going to let God do this. I'm not going to try to force my will here. I'm going to let God force His. That's why it says, don't take vengeance. Let God do it. Okay, the person that believes that backs off. He doesn't try to take vengeance. He says, sick 'em, God. If I can say that without being sacrilegious. He's just saying, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to let God do this. That is what Abraham's entire experience was proof of. He had been given a promise of a son as early as when he was 75 years old. And then God deliberately withheld the fulfillment of that for 25 more years, because He needed to teach Abraham what it meant to trust Him. And along the way, Abraham dropped the trust ball many times. Lied to a couple kings about Sarah's identity. Went to bed with another woman to produce a son. But finally, he got to the point where both Abraham and Sarah could say, okay, God said it. It's going to happen because God's going to do it. And when Sarah came to that, she received the strength to conceive seed. And they had a child. That's what Hebrews 11 says. She received the strength to conceive seed by faith. So, my point is this. In Romans 16, when it says it's got to be by faith, all that means is you're going to let God do this. And because of that attitude, grace comes into the play. And that means God starts acting. And that makes the promise certain. And it's certain to everybody, not to those who are just of the law, that is, the circumcised, the nation of Israel, but also to everybody who is of the faith of Abraham, which, in verse 17, includes an enormous number of nations. Father of a multitude of nations have I made you. Okay? Does that raise any questions that you want to raise, that you want to mention, or comments, observations, testimonies? Well, see, and this is the whole issue of Abraham being involved in this 25-year-long process of learning how to trust. God is working in the details of every day, manipulating these details so that we have to deal with the issues of faith and unbelief. And over the days and over the details and over the crises and all of this, we gradually come to this ability to believe. Even regeneration is not a one-time instant thing. It's a response to multiple confrontations with truth where you finally can't deny it any longer. I've said it this way. We can't make ourselves believe, but we can resist believing. When God makes the truth very clear to us, we can say, oh, no, I don't want that, and we can back away. But we really can't. We can't say, oh, I want this to be true. I'm going to make it true by believing it. You can't make yourself believe, but you can resist believing by pushing away from the light. God is the one who's the persuader. So basically what you're asking is what my responsibility is to stop resisting it when it's so obviously true. Well, it's yielding to the truth that's obviously there. The reason the religious establishment was so angry with Jesus is because they could not refute Him. He would say things in such a way that the authority and truthfulness of what He was saying was so black and white, so there, that it just made them mad that they couldn't resist that. I mean, they couldn't refute it. They could only resist it. And so they just got to the point where they said, if we don't kill Him, He's going to have everybody believe in this stuff. So the human issue is not the aggressive taking of believing. It's the aggressive resistance that finally you just say, okay, I give up. Okay, God, I give up. I believe it. Because that's where He's pushing us. And it's an act of divine activity of pushing people to the truth, where He pushes the truth on them, pushes it on them, pushes it on them. And they either finally harden themselves to where it makes no difference at all anymore, which is the sin unto death kind of concept. Or they give up and say, okay, okay. Yeah. It's the yielding. It's the surrender. I give up. Well, the initial yielding is the big issue, and then some of the other issues are some big and some not so big. But yeah, it's always a matter of having the truth hitting you in the face and you saying, oh, I wish that wasn't true. Because if that's true, then this is going to have to change. This is going to have to. I don't want these things to change. So I'm going to resist this. God says, oh, no. These things are going to go. So he comes back around. In my experience, what I've seen happen is that he'll touch a tender spot. And if I don't yield on it, he'll just go on to something else, and then he'll come back around and touch it again. And he has never quit. Not permanently. I mean, he has given me some breathing space on some things that are too touchy for me to be willing to trust him in, but he always comes back to it. And the next time he comes back to it, there's a little bit less resistance on my part to deal with that until finally I give up. That's the way it works. So, you know, you'll get these intense pressure situations, and then you'll have this life can be better kind of experience, and then all of a sudden it'll get intense again, and you know what God's doing. He's pushing an issue, and then he's giving you a breather, and then he's coming back and pushing it again. That's what it's all about. Yeah. Justification is the one-time event. That's the part of salvation that's the one-time thing. All the rest of salvation is involved in preparation for this servant kingdom thing. So wherever he wants to plug you into his kingdom, that determines how long you're going to live on this earth and how much stuff you're going to face as he's preparing you. Obviously, the guy on the cross isn't going to have a very significant position in the servant kingdom because he was only a believer for 2 or 3 hours before he died. Well, he's in the kingdom. But, you know, it's kind of one of those things where Peter said, by the skin of your teeth or the smell of smoke on your garments or whatever, you know. But it does. It makes a lot of difference. And it's really not in our hands to say. I know one person that regretted a great deal that she didn't come to know the Lord until she was in her 50s. I said, you can spend the rest of your life regretting that, or you can drop that and go on. Hey, past is past. You can't change it, so either get wallowing in it or get out of it and get on down the road.
It really comes down to it that 50, I mean, that amount of time that she didn't come to, it's really just a tiny little drop.
Sure. But in terms of the amount of time she would have had to be prepared for the kingdom if she'd have come when she was 20 as opposed to 50, those things are in God's hands, and you just better let them go there. And I'm not saying to be careless about your spiritual walk, but I am saying recognize it's not in your hands, not the final issues. They're not in your hand. You cannot make yourself believe what you don't believe, but you can do something about the level of resistance. But even that, you can't do a great deal about. Give me the right and left hand. If everybody buys the vision, yeah. The fact is, though, people don't all buy it at the same time, and you'll have people come in that haven't bought it at all, and you can't just say, you haven't bought the vision, out of here. You know, you can't do that. You have to bring them along. So normally the body has the same kind of things that I was talking about individually. There'll be pressure times, and there'll be smooth times, and then there'll be pressure times. And I've known leaders of bodies who want to write the Constitution so tight that they'll never have any of the pressure times. They've eliminated all the pressure points. Well, that just means they've eliminated all the people. Because people are where the pressure points come from. It's one of those things. And he didn't quit working on them. When he left, he sent the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit still had a lot of work to do. I mean, look at Peter. He went up there to Antioch or wherever it was, and he started playing the hypocrite. And Paul had to nail his hide to the wall in public, right in front of everybody, because he was backing away from the fundamental truth about the gospel. This is Peter. Well, So the point is, he isn't through with us till he's through with us, and that's when we exit. That's when we're out of here. You know when he's through with you when you wake up in heaven. Till then, it's still the process. All right, let's have a word of prayer and we'll quit. Father, we are grateful to you for the loyalty of your commitment and for the truthfulness and the certainty of the promises that you've made. We thank you for including us by even being willing to draw us together as individuals. When we look back, even in a group this small, and just look at the things you've done over the last 3 or 4 years to bring us to this point, we know that there were all kinds of little details that had to be worked out, and we marvel at the way you work. We're grateful for the life you've given us in your Son, Jesus. And we commit our way to you in his name. Amen.